Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. My name is Fred Flights, a senior vice president with the Center for Security Policy, and I'm substituting this week for a vacationing Frank Gaffney, the president of the center, who will be back on Monday. I have three fabulous guests today, but before I turn to them, I want to talk again about the North Korea situation. And I want to start with an extraordinary op-ed that was published in the New York Times yesterday by former National Security Advisor Susan Rice. And in this op-ed, Ms. Rice says that history shows that we can, if we must, tolerate nuclear weapons in North Korea, the same way we tolerated the far greater threat of thousands of Soviet nuclear weapons during the Cold War. Wow. That's what I call an aha moment. It's an aha moment because it confirms what many of us have long believed, that the basic assumption by the Obama administration concerning the Iranian and North Korean nuclear programs is that they do not pose a serious threat to international security and we can live with them. I believe that this was actually a secret assumption that Obama officials decided was too controversial to reveal, but it was always there. Now, I wrote in my book, Obama Bomb, A Dangerous and Growing National Security Fraud on the Nuclear Agreement with Iran, that this was the ideological basis for the nuclear agreement and with Iran. And I cited several experts who I believe influenced Barack Obama's thinking to decide to strike a nuclear deal with Iran, and he would have struck one with North Korea if they had not been so difficult to work with, that conceded the nuclear bomb to Iran. For example, I cited Paul Pillar, a former CIA officer who now teaches at Georgetown University, very well-respected foreign policy expert on the left. Well, he contended in a March-April Washington Monthly article that we can live with a nuclear Iran. That was actually the title of his piece. The late Joseph Waltz, a well-known professor of international relations at Columbia University, justified an Iranian nuclear bomb in a July-August 2012 Foreign Affairs article entitled, Why Iran Should Get the Bomb. And I've argued for a long time that there actually is this belief on the left that there's no problem with nations like North Korea and Iran getting the bomb. Now, Waltz actually argues that nuclear weapons are stabilizing, and he makes an argument that nuclear weapons being possessed by India and Pakistan has prevented armed conflict from breaking out. So why can't Iran have nuclear weapons? After all, Israel has them. Well, the reason that Iran and North Korea cannot have nuclear weapons is because they are state sponsors of terror who have threatened to use their military forces to destroy neighboring states. India and Pakistan are not making threats like that. Yes, Russia and China have nuclear arsenals. Russia has a large arsenal. But to say that Russian leaders are the same kind of rational actors as the leaders of North Korea and Iran, I simply don't think makes any sense. And when it comes to North Korea, Ms. Rice is justifying letting a state have nuclear weapons, which is testing ICBMs, which is threatening to attack the United States and its neighbors with nuclear weapons, which supposedly has 60 nuclear weapons now. This is according to a revelation from U.S. intelligence agencies by the Washington Post earlier this week. this is not a nuclear force that is a deterrent. This is an offensive nuclear force, an offensive missile force. And I tell you that the backward and naive foreign policy by the last administration that gave the North Koreans 8 years to advance this program, where basically they looked the other way. I like to say that there was leading from behind in the Middle East. In the Asia Pacific, there was no leading at all. There was an absolute and complete vacuum. The idea that this was acceptable to the last administration, and Rice is now claiming that we can just live with a North Korean nuclear arsenal, is really appalling. But it is an aha moment, because it helps explain at the end of the day what was behind this disastrous nuclear agreement with Iran. How could the Obama administration agree to a nuclear deal that allowed Iran to continue to enrich uranium with over 5,000 centrifuges, will give it a plutonium-producing heavy water reactor, has very weak verification provisions, and leaves out ballistic missiles, which are Iran's nuclear weapons delivery system? Well, the reason is that the Obama administration, and Mr. Obama in particular, didn't think Iran having nuclear weapons was a problem, that it wasn't a threat to American or international security. And it could be that Mr. Obama believed that somehow, by making Iran into a regional hegemon, that would somehow benefit regional security, that it would stabilize the region. I really don't understand that line of argument, but I have some colleagues who believe that this actually was also part of the rationale of the Obama administration of going along with this terrible agreement. And to support that agreement, I note that during the nuclear talks, there were a lot of side discussions about Syria and Iraq between U.S. representatives and Iran. And I don't think it's an accident that just after the nuclear agreement with Iran was announced in July 2015, the Iranians sent troops into Syria. I think basically Iran saw a green light to substantially increase its presence in the region. I want to turn back to the North Korea situation, because there were some other recent developments of note. North Korea this week has said that it is prepared to attack the island of Guam. This is an American territory located about 2,000 miles from North Korea. To do this, North Korean missiles would have to overfly Japan. Japan has said that is a red line. It will shoot down any missiles that do that. According to the North Korean press agency, North Korea is planning to fire about 4 missiles in the vicinity of Guam, and that the government is preparing a Guam strike plan. Well, I discuss later in this program with Washington Times columnist Bill Gertz about how North Korea probably does not have missiles accurate enough to go as far as Guam. But frankly, I think we have to consider the worst case scenario, because North Korea's nuclear missile programs have advanced far faster than anyone had imagined. I don't think they could get that far, but we shouldn't be taking any chances. Now, President Trump responded to this statement about North Korea's threat to fire missiles near Guam, and criticism of a statement he made earlier in the week that he will respond aggressively, that North Korea will face fire and fury like the world has never seen, by saying on Thursday that maybe his response was not tough enough, that the American people are tired of these threats by North Korea, and that he's prepared to stand up to them. In my view, the words of President Trump and the information released this week on North Korea's nuclear capabilities are part of a strategy to increase the pressure on North Korea, to increase the pressure on China, and to get China to abide by UN Security Council sanctions to address this growing threat with North Korea. I'm optimistic we're going to see some progress over the next couple months, but I got to tell you, I am cautiously optimistic. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio. I'm Fred Flight, substituting for Frank Gaffney. My first guest today will be Center for Security Policy expert Alex Van Ness. Please stay tuned.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Fred Flight substituting for Frank Gaffney. My first guest today will be Alex Van Nest. He is Director, Middle East Peace and Security Project at the Center for Security Policy. And I want to talk to him about some rather pressing Middle East issues concerning the state of Israel. Alex, welcome.
Hi, Fred. Thanks for having me on.
Alex, I want to first start talking to you about a woman named Linda Sarsour, who was co-chair of the Women's March that took place after President Trump's Inauguration Day. Now, this is an interesting individual who not long ago called for jihad against the Trump administration. And when many of us complain that that appeared to be a call to violence or hate, her defenders violently disagreed, saying that she wasn't calling for violence or hate. That wasn't in the cards at all. And the way I read it is that she seemed to have in her mind some kind of soft, fluffy kind of jihad, not the kind of jihad that terrorists might be carrying out. Give us your take on the story with Linda Sarsour.
Her speech was at the Islamic Society for North America's annual convention, where she called for jihad. Our colleague Kyle Scheidler wrote an excellent piece in the Washington Examiner about the implications of her statements and why they mean more than her excuse that it simply means struggle. But that specific reference to jihad wasn't what hit red lights in my head. It was her defense and call that her mentor at the beginning of her speech was Imam Siraj Wahaj that really got me concerned, because Siraj Wahaj had openly called for violent jihad in America in the past, as well as he was also implicated and connected to the 1993 World Trade Center bombings. So the fact that she looks up to him as a mentor was the most disconcerting for me.
Now, tell me about her affiliations. She seems to have some friendship with Bernie Sanders. She's executive director of something called the Arab American Association of New York. Tell me more about her background, who she's linked to.
Yeah, so she has been the executive director for the Arab American Association of New York for, I would say, about a dozen years. From what I understand, she's recently left that position, and she's now she started her own organization, Empower, which is a Muslim advocacy organization. She's long been connected to organizations such as CARE, MAF, and ICNA, which have been unindicted co-conspirators in the Holy Land Foundation trial, which sent money to Hamas. And she used the last year during the campaign, she was used the stump for Bernie Sanders and his presidential campaign.
Well, I'm glad that you're following this person. I have to say that anyone in this day and age who is calling for jihad against the President of the United States, I think has a lot to answer for. This, in my view, is like shouting fire in a crowded theater. Alex, I want to move on to a very compelling article you recently published in The Federalist titled, "Why is a pro-Israel group lobbying to preserve payouts to terrorists?" And in this article, you call on the State Department to end something that you refer to as the Pay for Slay program. Tell us what this is all about.
Yeah, so the Pay for Slay program is effectively the Palestinian Authority pays the families and the perpetrators of violence against Jews. They give stipends and regular salaries to people who to terrorists, people who kill Jews. For example, the Solomon family, who recently during the recent riots in Jerusalem, a 19-year-old kid walked in, by the name of Omar al-Abed, walked into the Solomon family's house on Shabbat and murdered three members of the family in cold blood. And the Palestinian Authority under Mahmoud Abbas is now paying the family of al-Abed $3,120 per month for the rest of his life.
So let me jump to something here. So the Senate passed something called the Taylor Force Act in the Senate Foreign Affairs Committee, that will cut funds to the Palestinian Authority if it doesn't end this program. And there were 17 senators supporting it and four opposed. I want you to talk about this act, and I'd like you to talk about the four senators opposed, Cory Booker, Christopher Murphy, Jeff Merkley, and Tom Udall, and how they could explain how they could oppose such a bill.
Yeah, so the bill, the Taylor Force Act, which was named after U.S. Army officer Taylor Force, who was murdered by a Palestinian terrorist whose family is receiving a stipend for their for that act. This bill has wide and broad bipartisan support. Recently, the Senate majority minority leader just signed on as a co-sponsor for the Democrats, and the members who opposed it, Cory Booker, was the biggest shock by most people's standards. A lot of people don't understand why he opposed the bill, especially considering that he has a large Jewish community in his state of New Jersey. He's regularly been seen as a moderate pro-Israel voice in the Senate, on the Senate Democrat side. However, two very important members who voted against it.
Jeff Merkley, Christopher Murphy, and Tom Udall also voted against it.
Yeah, so Senator Udall, and as well as Senator Merkley, both received sizable financial contributions from the organization J Street.
Isn't J Street a pro-Jewish PAC? I ask sarcastically.
As sarcastically, they claim to be a pro-Israel, pro-peace organization, but every action that they take, every advocacy position that they take tends to be against the grain of the mainstream of pro-Israel groups take, and they are often seen as being very pro-Palestinian instead of being pro-Israeli, and to an extent that they're anti-Israel. They have given platforms to pro-BDS, boycott, divest, and sanction speakers and advocates. And they have been lobbying over the past year or two against the Taylor Force Act and removing funds from the Palestinian Authority, despite the fact that about half of the PA's budget is dished out to this pay-for-slay program.
Yeah, I mean, J Street really puzzles me. They bill themselves as a pro-Israel, pro-peace organization. They also strongly campaign in favor of the disastrous nuclear agreement with Iran, which poses such a dire threat to the very existence of the State of Israel. So I guess it's par for the course that they would be opposing the Taylor Force Act. Well, Alex Van Ness, thank you so much for your analysis today. This is Fred Flight, substituting for Frank Gaffney on Secure Freedom Radio. Next up, Bill Gertz will be talking about North Korea and a number of other national security topics. Stay tuned.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Fred Flight, substituting for Frank Gaffney. My next guest is Bill Gertz. He is a senior editor at the Washington Free Beacon. He is an Inside the Ring columnist at the Washington Times and author of a new book titled I, War, War and Peace in the Information Age. And I got to tell you that Bill is, I think, one of the smartest national security journalists I know in this country. Bill Gertz, welcome.
Hi, Fred. Good to be on the show.
Bill, I wanted to start by talking to you about North Korea, which I think is the national security question that is most in the news right now. You recently wrote an article in the Washington Free Beacon entitled U.S. and Guam Shielded from North Korean Missiles by High-Tech Defenses. I'd like to hear you talk about that and your concerns about the possibility that North Korean missiles could actually get anywhere near Guam.
Yeah, this is a very important story, I felt, to take a look at our missile defenses. There's been a lot of hype about the North Korean missile threat. And of course, anti-defense advocates who dislike missile defense have often played down the reliability and the capability of these awesome technological defenses that we have, both for long-range missiles as well as medium and short-range missiles. Very effective. We have the ground-based mid-course defense, as they call it, which is a total of 36 interceptors. They're deployed mostly in Alaska and Southern California at Vandenberg Air Force Base. And these are the ones that could knock out any long-range North Korean missile fired at the U.S. 36, it's a very effective, highly automated system. And again, it's based on satellite launches. As I pointed, I interviewed Trey Obering, the former director of MDA, and he said that the first thing that would happen, we'd detect the launch, and then right away, if its flight path would hit any defended area in the U.S., this automated defense system goes into place, which would lead to a firing of an interceptor or several, if need be. For regional defenses, we have the Terminal High Altitude Area Defense, or THAAD, deployed on Guam. And this is, again, an amazing system. It's a ground-based system for intermediate-range missiles, and it's conducted 14 tests or 15 tests, and in each test, it's had a success. In addition to that, we also have Navy Aegis ships, destroyers and cruisers, that are equipped with highly advanced SM-3 missiles. And all of these can be integrated. They can use what is known as cooperative engagement, so that we have radars that can detect and track these missiles and then guide interceptors to them. So it's something that if we had listened to liberal arms control advocates back in the early 2000s, late 90s, we wouldn't have this option. We wouldn't have the option to be able to shoot down any of these missiles. The only options we'd have would be preemptive strikes, which could start a war, or retaliation after we're attacked.
Well, realistically, what is the threat to Guam from North Korean missiles?
Well, they have a couple of intermediate and medium-range missiles. One is called the Hwasong-12, and the other is the Musudong. And these are, again, missiles that can range Guam. The issue for the North Koreans is the reliability of their missiles. They're not really that reliable. So they, again, they're throwing the dice when they attempt to even test a missile near Guam, because it would trigger a massive retaliation. We saw this morning on Twitter that the president has announced that all bases and facilities and equipment are in place to take action against North Korea if the regime were stupid enough to try something like that.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. I don't think we're hearing this kind of analysis in the mainstream media. I want to turn to something you recently wrote for your Washington Times Inside the Ring column, China's new long-range missile, a missile which you said is called the DF-31AG. Tell us about this.
Yes, I first disclosed the existence of this new variant of the DF-31. The Chinese, again, they're the missiles or us of world powers, and they have so many different kinds of missiles, from short range to medium, intermediate range to long range. And this is a new long range missile that was unveiled July 30th during the annual military parade marking the Communist Party's founding of the People's Liberation Army, as the Chinese military is called. And they unveiled this new missile about the first test of this 2 years ago, back in 2015, when the Pentagon had designated it as the DF-31B. The thing that's unique about it is that, unlike its earlier variants, it carries multiple warheads and it has a much longer range, enhanced version of their earlier DF-31s.
Now, finally, you also wrote a recent article concerning, this is in the Washington Free Beacon, that China had carried out a flight test of an anti-satellite missile. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this is a real concern. The Chinese really going massively forward with development of weaponry. And last month, in late July, they conducted a test of what's called the DN-3. This is a direct descent anti-satellite missile that's launched from the ground and is capable of hitting satellites in space at various altitudes. Again, recently I interviewed the commander of the U.S. Strategic Command, General John Hyten, and he expressed real concern about the growing space warfare capabilities of not just China, but Russia as well. And he said, our satellites are vulnerable. And of course, our strategic satellites are incredibly valuable for our military, the ability to do command and control, to do navigation, to do precision guidance, all comes from our satellites. And if the Chinese are able to knock out these satellites, we're in a real disadvantage in any kind of a regional conflict or global conflict.
I guess the Russians have a similar program.
Yes. According to General Hyten, the Russians are also developing counter-space weaponry, but they're not as advanced as the Chinese, which have conducted a number of different tests. The Chinese ASAT program ranges from ground-based lasers and jammers that can damage, disrupt, or destroy satellites in space, to these direct descent missiles. They have several of them, as well as satellites. They're specializing in small maneuvering satellites that can smash into or grab orbiting satellites and destroy them in that way. So they've got a number of paths that they're working on. The U.S. has no similar programs at all. Obviously, General Hyten was saying, look, this is a contested environment. We have to realize that, and we need to up our defenses in space.
Yeah, I had heard that China had attack satellites. Now, could some of these satellites be using electromagnetic pulse, or is this something you think China is also researching?
There's no question that they've worked on electromagnetic pulse weapons. And the equipment that they use to test their nuclear equipment, their nuclear warheads and others, for electromagnetic pulse. And of course, it doesn't take much to use a test equipment to turn it into a directed energy electromagnetic pulse weapon. So they're definitely making strides in developing that kind of a weapon that can be used to knock out the electronics by creating this electromagnetic pulse that simulates the pulse that's created from a nuclear blast.
Is China hardening its military hardware against electromagnetic pulse?
Yes. Clearly, they've not only are they hardening it, but they've been doing exercises where they have all of their electronics hardened against electromagnetic pulse. In other words, they're gearing up for nuclear war in the future.
Well, Bill Gertz, I got to wrap it up there. Thank you so much for your analysis. This is Fred Fleitz with Secure Freedom Radio, substituting for Frank Affney. Thank you for listening.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Fred Fleitz substituting for Frank Gaffney. My next guest is Michael Cutler. He is a retired senior special agent of the former Immigration and Naturalization Services. He also hosts the radio show, the Michael Cutler Hour, on Friday evenings on Blog Talk. Michael, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Fred. Happy Friday to you.
You too. Michael, you wrote a very interesting piece that recently appeared in Front Page Magazine on sanctuary cities. Tell our listeners about this story.
Well, you know, this is Orwellian, this notion of calling cities that harbor illegal aliens call themselves sanctuaries. We think of a sanctuary as being a place of serenity, peace, and safety. The immigration process at ports of entry, the inspections process, one that I did for the first 4 years of my 30-year career with the INS before I became a special agent, was to screen out people who would do harm to the United States or work illegally, thereby depriving Americans of jobs. How in the world is it a sanctuary when you have people invited into a city knowing full well that if they ran the border, perhaps because they're criminals, terrorists, fugitives, those are categories of aliens to be excluded, that they have the welcome mat being spread for them in these cities? These cities should properly be called magnet cities, magnets for fugitives, for gangbangers, for terrorists, for law violators. So now we've got these mayors of sanctuary cities suing the federal government for money that the Trump administration wants to withhold because, quite frankly, these folks are committing a felony. If you or I harbored or shielded, aided, abetted, encouraged, or induced aliens to enter illegally or remain thereafter illegally, you'd be prosecuted criminally for a serious felony. Last point on this, the 9/11 commission, to which I provided testimony, made it crystal clear that 9/11 and other terrorist attacks could not have been carried out if the immigration system worked properly. It identified multiple failures of the immigration system. So these sanctuary cities are undermining not only public safety for the residents of their cities, but national security for the entire country.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio. I'm Fred Fleitz, substituting for Frank Affney. My guest today is Michael Cutler, retired senior special agent with the former Immigration and Naturalization Services. Michael, I want to turn to another article you recently wrote on Front Page Magazine titled U.S. Military Infiltrated by Alien Recruits. And in this piece, you say that Pentagon investigators have found security risks in the government's immigrant recruitment program and that infiltration is feared. Tell us about this piece.
Well, you know, we have enabled aliens to enter the United States legally and then offer them opportunities to get a pathway to citizenship or get on a pathway to citizenship if their services are unique and needed by the military. So if someone came on a student visa or a tourist visa, they speak a particular language or they have particular insight into the geography of an area that's of strategic military interest, they can then avail themselves the opportunity to join the military and be placed on the pathway to citizenship. Problem is that a bunch of these folks, and the Pentagon won't tell us if it's, you know, 2 or 200 or 2,000, but they have found that a number, and they're holding that close to their vest, a number of these aliens have disappeared. The concern is that they specifically joined the military to basically get their hands on our training book, our playbook, learn military tactics, and may surface at some point down the road. This is similar to the Enlist Act, which I've written about. The Enlist Act would provide the same opportunities for illegal aliens who entered the United States surreptitiously. This is a bad situation because it's impossible to vet these people adequately. So when the Trump administration talks about the need for what he calls extreme vetting, the president calls extreme vetting, we're having a problem doing vetting with aliens from many countries around the world, not just those six that are on that list of the president's executive order. And the consequence could be quite severe. It took just 19 terrorists on 9/11 to inflict more casualties than did the entire Japanese fleet at Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941. I have to make a quick observation. The Supreme Court has ruled against the president using that authority that he has under the immigration law to deny entry to aliens from certain countries. The media calls it a travel ban. They refuse to use the real name. I think if they use the real name, there'd no longer be any arguments. The actual name of that executive order is the Protect the Nation from the Entry of Foreign Terrorists into the United States. By calling it a travel ban, it's been mislabeled as some sort of a xenophobic desire on the part of the president. If they use the honest name, then the purpose and significance would be crystal clear, wouldn't it?
I think that's right. Now, there's been some discussion lately about the specifics of the president's restrictions on immigration, and some of them have dealt with the issue of chain migration and the admission of family members who are admitted legally into this country. Can you talk about chain migration and how that relates to the current state of restrictions on immigration from certain countries of terrorist concern?
Sure, absolutely. And by the way, it's remarkable that the courts turned around and said, well, this is about keeping, you know, grandparents from their children and so forth. The president's authority under Title 8, United States Code, Section 1182F, the president has sole authority at his discretion if he deems it to be against the best interests of the United States. I think the admission of terrorists qualify to keep such aliens out of the country for whatever period he may deem appropriate. But where chain migration is concerned, today, when an alien becomes a lawful immigrant and ultimately becomes a United States citizen, he or she may petition the government to permit all of their siblings, and in other words, their brothers and sisters, and we're talking about adults now, so that also means the spouses of their brothers and sisters and all of their minor children. So if we're talking about an alien from countries that traditionally have large families, you could have an alien become a citizen at age 50, suddenly petition to have eight brothers and sisters and all of their wives and all of their minor children enter the United States. Suddenly, one immigrant becomes 70 immigrants. Certainly, nuclear families travel as a family. Anybody coming here to live permanently should be able, and under the Trump administration, would continue to be able to bring all of their minor children and their spouses to live with them. That's reasonable, it's humane, it's appropriate. But why in the world do we also broaden that to bring in this extended family? I have an easy test. And by the way, I have no problem with mothers and fathers of immigrants coming here once that immigrant becomes a citizen. Perhaps they're elderly, they want to keep an eye on them, maybe they're helping with the children and so forth. That's fine. But other than the parents, if you cannot reasonably expect to be placed on somebody's health insurance program, then you shouldn't be given a green card to live in the United States permanently. We should expedite the process for family members to visit with their immigrant families here in the United States. But to provide green cards, you know, we admit more lawful immigrants than the rest of the world, about a million a year. The Trump administration wants to cut that in half, and that would bring it back to levels that existed a decade ago. And what he also wants to do is have aliens speak English if they're going to become immigrants. And there's been some outcry about that. I saw where Stephen Miller got into it with this reporter, Jim Acosta.
And be skilled. We want skilled immigrants coming in, too.
Skilled and English speaking. And now, here's the point. We want aliens who immigrate to be ready for success. When I wanted to become a federal agent, I didn't go to the federal government and say, I just got out of high school, train me. I came to the federal government with a four-year degree, and I had scored in the top 2% in the United States on the Federal Service Entrance Exam. When people want to be doctors, they don't show up in a hospital and say, here I am, I just got out of high school. You go to medical school and so forth.
Well, Michael Cutler, I'm afraid we need to wrap it up there. This is Fred Flights on Secure Freedom Radio, substituting for Frank Gaffney. Thank you for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.